Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It's Final Four weekend for the men and for the women. Hey, wait a minute. Doesn't that make it Final Eight? Ahead on Only a Game, a preview of all the action. Also, the Dodgers prepare to move past the McCourt era. Tim Kirkchin weighs in on what the term opening day actually means, and a conversation with Mitchell Nathanson, author of A People's History of Baseball. Also ahead, drag racers look for new venues as the old ones close.
You know, we had 12 or 14 tracks, so you lose one, you still had 12. But when you only have 5 or 6, 7, so when you lose one, that's a big deal.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This evening in New Orleans, the NCAA Men's Final Four begins with Louisville taking on Kentucky. In the late game, Ohio State faces Kansas. The winners will play for the national title Monday night. All of the teams have long basketball traditions, and as Only a Game's Doug Trabue reports, two of them have hardly met, while the other two know each other all too well.
There are a lot of Louisville Cardinals fans in Louisville, Kentucky. But there are a lot of Kentucky Wildcats fans all over the Bluegrass State. At a press conference Tuesday, Cardinals head coach Rick Pitino explained the societal impacts of the red-blue divide.
They have as many fans in our city, and it ends up with a lot of bad marriages, a lot of mixed marriages that end up bad. You know, you have a Louisville woman with a Kentucky man, and it always ends bad. And it's,
On Monday at a dialysis center in Georgetown, Kentucky, a 68-year-old Kentucky fan and a 71-year-old Louisville supporter started arguing about the upcoming game. The 68-year-old man, who was hooked up to a dialysis machine, held up a finger. Not the one you see on giant foam hands. The older man responded by punching him in the face. Yahoo Sports National College columnist and Only a Game analyst Pat Forty lives in Louisville.
You know, I don't care what people say about Duke and North Carolina. I don't care what people say about Kansas and Missouri. This is the most hardcore, passionate, year-round, everyday battle between the fans sort of rivalry that there is in the sport.
There's another wrinkle in the rivalry, the coaches. Louisville's Rick Pitino spent 8 years as the head coach at Kentucky. In the Final Four in 1996, Pitino and Kentucky knocked off John Calipari and UMass on the way to a Wildcats national championship. Today, Calipari coaches Kentucky, but on Tuesday, he declared that rivalries go out the window when the stakes are this high.
When you're playing at this stage of the season, a win or a loss doesn't matter if it's against a school 12 miles from you or 1,000 miles. It really does not matter.
The Wildcats and Cardinals have never played a game on a bigger stage than they will tonight. Kentucky's the favorite. The Wildcats entered the tournament as the number one overall seed. Louisville is a 4 seed. It's unlikely the Cardinals will be able to stop the Wildcats' offense, but to win, they'll have to slow it down. Kentucky has 6 players who average at least 10 points a game. The Wildcats are tough on the other end, too. Freshman star forward Anthony Davis averages more than 4 block shots per contest. Pat Forty says the loser will have to deal with more than just the pain of failing to win a national championship.
This is a game people are going to talk about for the rest of their lives in the state of Kentucky. You know, as great as it would be to win, it would be worse to lose. The loser is going to have to hear about this endlessly.
The other half of the bracket features Ohio State and Kansas, both 2 seeds. This week in Lawrence, Kansas senior Emily Siss considered the possibility of a Jayhawks national title.
It would be like an exclamation mark at my time at KU. I mean, being a senior, I've watched this KU basketball since I was a freshman, and being able to see the team bring home a trophy would probably be one of the best days of my life.
Despite that declaration, it's not like the Jayhawks are the Chicago Cubs. They won their third national championship in 2008, and this is Kansas's 14th Final Four appearance. And although football gets top billing at Ohio State, Buckeyes basketball has made at least one NCAA tourney appearance in every decade since the 1930s and went to three consecutive basketball finals from 1960 to 62, earning one title. Again, Pat Forde.
You know, if you look at Jerry Lucas and John Havlicek and playing in multiple championships in the early 60s, they've been very competitive throughout in the Big Ten, the 70s and 80s. In the 90s as well, and then 2001 they make the Final Four, 2007 they make the Final Four, and I think with Thad Matta, you know, the way he's been able to recruit, they're going to be a player nationally for the foreseeable future.
The Buckeyes and Jayhawks aren't rivals. They're more like acquaintances. They met earlier this season, but tonight's matchup will be just their 10th game ever. The Jayhawks are led by big man Thomas Robinson and guard Tyshawn Taylor, who each average about 17 points a game. Ohio State features Jared Sullinger and Deshaun Thomas. In wins over Cincinnati and Syracuse, the two forwards combined for a total of 82 points. In 2007, Buckeyes head coach Thad Matta guided his team to the title game, but lost. After Ohio State's win over Syracuse Saturday, Matta reflected on that last visit to the Final Four.
I probably didn't enjoy the moment as much as I wanted to or needed to, but truth be told, I probably won't enjoy this one either, and we'll get down there and try to play our best basketball.
Coaches stressing out and losing sleep is as much a Final Four tradition as anything that happens on the court. And there's only one cure, cutting down the nets on Monday night. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
Tomorrow in Denver, Baylor will face Stanford and Notre Dame will take on UConn to determine which teams play Tuesday night for the women's NCAA championship. Joining me now to discuss the Final Four weekend is Michelle Smith, who writes about the women's game for ESPNW. Michelle, on Tuesday, UConn looked great in the second half against Kentucky, and they won that game by 25 points. Notre Dame was even more dominant in beating Maryland 80-49 to reach the Final Four. Is it the Huskies or the Irish advancing to the championship game?
Oh, you know, I think I'm going to go with Notre Dame. They've had this run of wins against Connecticut, except for the Big East championship game, I believe, when Connecticut finally got them this year. But Notre Dame's a pretty complete team, and they've been playing so well all season long, and I'm going to go with Notre Dame.
On the other side of the brackets, neither Stanford nor Baylor has been seriously tested. Anybody could have guessed that that would be the case for Baylor. They are 38-0 this season. But did you expect Stanford to win all of their tournament games as convincingly as they have?
Every matchup that came through for Stanford in this bracket, there was a yeah, but. There was, yeah, but Hampton's really small and quick, and they're going to give them problems. And then it was West Virginia. Yeah, but they're very physical, and they're going to give Stanford a hard time. And, you know, and so Stanford made its way through all the yeah, buts, and they just kept winning really, really convincingly. They're a very good team, and the sisters, the Ogumike sisters, are outstanding players. If Griner isn't Griner, then Nneka might be the National Player of the Year. She's had that good of a season.
Of course, you mentioned Brittany Griner before I even had an opportunity to mention that she's been dunking, scoring scores of points, blocking shots also in record numbers. Is there any way that her Baylor team can be denied this championship?
You know, I think there's a way. I don't think it's necessarily going to happen. I never buy into whether a team is absolutely invincible. She is an extraordinary player. People call her a game changer, and she absolutely changes any game she's in, that's for sure. And Baylor has plenty of weapons. I mean, Odyssey Sims is a great point guard. They've got a lot of really good players on that team. This is not a Brittany Griner-only show. But I think it's interesting that, you know, people sort of don't see a way in which they can be beat, and I don't believe that. I don't necessarily think Stanford will win, or even the next team that plays them will win. But I certainly think that this isn't a done deal.
There's a subplot in the Baylor story that surfaced just recently. Kim Mulkey, their coach, has been diagnosed with Bell's palsy. Is this likely to have any impact on the game? I know Bell's palsy is something people generally recover from in a fairly short time.
You know, it's so hard to know. It's a tough break for her, certainly. It's certainly a tough break for Baylor at this late stage when they're trying to get ready to go. And it's just happened so recently, and it's really hard to know how it's going to impact them.
I thought it was interesting that Coach Mulkey told the press the other day, it will not have any impact on my ability to yell at them.
Well, I believe her. I believe her. Kim Mulkey is one of the best yellers in the game, and I don't know, you know, I don't think anybody's going to impair that ability.
All right, Michelle, you're on the record as saying you don't think anybody is unbeatable, but it can get uncomfortable sitting on a fence. So give us a prediction for a winner.
Well, I'm going to say Baylor, and that's not a huge stretch because I think through the year, I mean, nobody's beaten them yet. They've played everybody but Stanford at this point that's in that Final Four field and beaten them relatively soundly. I mean, I think you have to look at Baylor, but I hate to go into a Final Four, you know, assuming a foregone conclusion. It certainly is not as much fun.
Michelle Smith writes about women's basketball for ESPNW. Thank you very much for speaking with me, Michelle.
Thank you, Bill.
Yesterday, it was reported that New Orleans Saints head coach Sean Payton, whom NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell had suspended for a year, would appeal that ruling. Payton's suspension, which had been scheduled to begin tomorrow, was based on the coach's knowledge of the Saints' so-called bounty hunting program, which paid New Orleans players to knock their opponents out of games, and the commissioner's conclusion that the coach lied to league officials attempting to investigate that program. There has been speculation this week that retired coach Bill Parcells might take over for Sean Payton. Parcells, who has led the Giants, Patriots, Jets, and Cowboys, said that if he was offered the opportunity, quote, I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't consider it. In that assertion, Bill Parcells referenced his own experience as a young coach when mentors such as Chuck Knoll, Chuck Knox, and Tom Landry, quote, were there for me. If Mr. Parcells is able to wrench this story about the consequences of promoting injury to opposing players for money and then lying about it into a morality tale about loyalty, responsibility, and not being a hypocrite, certainly the plot will have taken a weird turn. But this is the National Football League we're talking about, a bizarro world in which the commissioner can blow the bugle for a longer regular season and simultaneously maintain that player health and safety is his primary concern. A world in which current players signed on to a program under which they tried to injure their fellows in the workplace, while over 300 ex-players are suing the NFL for injuries they suffered on the job. Those lawsuits pretty much obligated Roger Goodell to bring the hammer down on Sean Payton. When they need settling, the commissioner better be able to point to some evidence that he doesn't countenance mayhem for pay, except within the rules. No matter the disposition of Sean Payton's appeal or who ends up coaching the Saints, that's the challenge most likely to concern Mr. Goodell these days. The commissioner's life was further complicated yesterday when Demora Smith, head of the NFL Players Association, said that although the commissioner has said he will determine punishments for Saints players, he has yet to provide the Players Association with any evidence implicating players in the pay-to-injure scheme. It's 19 minutes past the hour. I got the horse right here. His name is Paul Revere, only it isn't. His name is Tebow Go, and another one's named Tebow Gator. This is all according to the Jockey Club, the organization in charge of registering names for thoroughbred racehorses. They've also been asked to okay Tebow Time, Tebow's Big Play, and inevitably, Tebowing and Tebow Mania. There would probably be a Tebow Stud, too, if the Jockey Club's rules didn't say no name could end in the word stud. And Tebow leads Jets to Super Bowl win if names weren't limited to 18 characters or less.
I've been through the desert on a horse with no name. It felt good to be out of the rain. In the desert, you can remember your name.
Hi, I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, magic returns to Chavez Ravine. But first, the Major League Baseball season began on Wednesday, unless it begins on Wednesday. Confused? So am I, which is why ESPN's Tim Kirkjian is here. Tim, Seattle and Oakland played two games in Japan this week, yet the official MLB calendar lists Wednesday's game between the Cardinals and the Marlins as opening night. What's going on?
Well, this is kind of confusing to me, too. The baseball season officially has begun, but I am not recognizing opening day until April the 4th and maybe even April the 5th when a whole bunch of teams really start to play. I understand what baseball is trying to do, playing games in Japan, in order to globalize the sport a little bit more, but I really am not sure that is necessary to play games in Japan just to show the Japanese that we play baseball over here in the United States. I think that's common knowledge, and Ichiro got four hits in his first game, and he made a great play in his second game. But let's get on to the real games in April. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Speaking of St. Louis, the team will be without longtime slugger Albert Pujols. Any reason to believe the Cardinals will maintain their world championship form?
Bill, I still think they're the team to beat in their division. Now, it is not going to be easy, but it is not a very strong division. The Brewers have taken a bigger step backwards, in my opinion, than the Cardinals have. Cardinals lost Albert Pujols, the Brewers lost Prince Fielder, and suddenly the National League Central is up for grabs. And I think the Cardinals have as good a chance as anyone to win that division. Just to show you how this works, I had the Reds as the leader in the division, and then their closer, Ryan Madsen, had to have Tommy John surgery, so I replaced them. I'm really confused by the National League Central, but having said that, the Cardinals have as good a chance as anyone to win it. And remember, they didn't even win the division last year, yet they won the World Series. Funny how it works in baseball.
The Rangers had the 2011 World Series won, or they appeared to, but oops, they gave it away in memorable fashion. Has the pain of that lost opportunity inspired the Rangers to improve during the offseason?
Yes, Bill. I saw the Rangers recently in spring training, and that was about the first question I asked. Is the pain over with? Is it serve as motivation? All the standard questions. And I got the standard answers, but the Rangers have moved on, clearly. Ian Kinsler looked at me, their second baseman, and said, "You guys know how we roll. Everything's forgotten. We're moving ahead." And Michael Young, who's been there longer than any Ranger, told me, "Look, I have a slightly different look at this." He said, "I was really proud to even be in that World Series, and I don't take away from it that we choked it. I take away that we got out-executed by the Cardinals." But he said, "That's one of the greatest World Series ever played. I was proud to be in it, and now, of course, the goal is to get back again this year and this time win it for the Rangers." And given that they are an improved team, they added Yu Darvish to the top of their rotation. I think their bullpen's going to be better. They have a really good team. They have a chance to go back for a third year in a row.
There will be a new playoff format beginning this fall. Will the addition of another wild card team in each league create a more interesting postseason?
I think so, Bill. I mean, it's almost impossible to be better than the final game of the season last year, regular season, and then the playoffs. It's almost impossible to do better than that as far as drama and everything else goes. But I think just mathematically, with another wild card team in, what happened that final night of the season with so many teams back and forth, maybe we have a chance to duplicate that. But I think mathematically you look at it and say the chances of that night happening again, more teams in play, more possibilities, I think it's a good thing for the wild card. Plus, we're going to have a one-game playoff to advance in the playoffs. That should be really interesting. And I think the extra wild card also brings a greater emphasis to the regular season, that if you win your division, then you don't have to play in that one-game wild card playoff in order to advance. Nobody wants to do that, and that's going to be an interesting situation this year.
Finally, Tim, I recently heard your interview with Rangers pitcher Derek Holland, during which he impersonated you and the late great broadcaster Harry Carey. He did Carey impeccably, but I have to say there are at least three members of the Only a Game staff who can do a much better job of impersonating you.
We had a lot of Tim Kirkjian impersonations this spring around Major League Baseball. And everyone thought he could do me better than I can do me. Derek Holland was just the last of about 10 guys that tried to do me, including my colleague Aaron Boone. I can tell you, Bill, if that's the way I sound in real life, then I seriously have to consider getting another profession here, because if that's my real voice, I am in a lot of trouble here.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and joins me to talk about the game from time to time as well. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
It's time to swing away. Who is better, Mantle or Mace? It's opening day.
The tumultuous days during which Frank McCourt owned the Los Angeles Dodgers are coming to an end. On Tuesday night, longtime baseball executive Stan Kasten and some guy named Magic Johnson bought the team. Joining me to discuss the implications of that transaction is Steve Dilbeck of the LA Times. Steve, welcome back to the program.
Hey, it's good to talk to you again.
Let's talk first about addition by subtraction. There must be a feeling of relief among baseball fans in L.A. that the Dodgers' stories will no longer necessarily begin with the calculations of debt and speculation about who gets what in a divorce.
Well, there's been unbelievable the reaction, and to some extent it would have been similar if you had bought the team. You know, they just wanted Frank McCourt gone, you know, and it couldn't happen soon enough, or he couldn't go far enough away. So the fact that he's finally agreed to sell the team is a cause for celebration. And then the fact that Magic Johnson is going to be kind of the face of this group, and he's one of the most beloved sports figures in Los Angeles history because he used to kick the Boston Celtics' butts all the time. That just magnified it, you know?
The purchase price was reported to be $2 billion, a nice round figure. Does that bail Frank McCourt out of the debt that he'd previously accumulated?
Yeah, it was actually, and he also got another $1.5 million for the parking lot. So he actually, it was $21.5 million there for him. And I was just talking to a friend of mine, Greg Patton at the Riverside Press Enterprise, and he commented that Frank finally has enough money now that he can go buy a Major League Baseball team. He's going to walk out of this incredibly, disgustingly, with $1 billion.
Stan Kasten, of course, has plenty of experience in baseball. He used to be the president of the Atlanta Braves, and he held the same position with the Washington Nationals. But now he's an owner. What can Dodgers fans anticipate on his watch?
Well, he's a highly respected executive, and he knows how to build an organization that wins. I mean, he's not the general manager. He had an outstanding one in Atlanta with Schurholz, and we'll have to see if he ends up keeping Ned Coletti in that position in L.A. or goes somewhere else. But he's going to understand not only the immediate way to turn a team around, but long term. So there's going to be a re-emphasis with the Dodgers back into the minor league systems, back into the scouting, and all those things that Frank had just turned his back on.
The headliner in this sale, the fellow that you've called the face of the franchise, is, of course, Magic Johnson. He's said that he won't be a silent partner. Do you have any sense yet of how he will be involved with the ball club?
Well, what he says is he's going to get an office and he's going to move in and he's going to be there every day. And he's not going to pretend that he knows the inner workings of curveballs and pickoff plays or whatever. But he does know the community. I think you'll see him interacting with political types and organizations. And he'll do what he does best is he's a point guard. He's going to get out there and lead, get this team back into its rightful place in the Los Angeles community.
The purchase price, again, $2 billion plus, set a record for pro sports teams. Does this have owners throughout the land broadly grinning, or are the Dodgers sufficiently unusual so that their purchase price doesn't necessarily mean that all teams everywhere are suddenly more valuable?
Well, there's a rising tide thing here for everybody a little bit, particularly the large market teams. But there is something a little bit unique in the Los Angeles situation, and that one is arguably the premier team in the National League through the years, and it has its TV contract coming up next year, which is going to be worth gazillions of dollars. It just all worked together to make the man who took this team into bankruptcy ridiculously rich.
Steve, the Dodgers went the way of giveaways and promotions to try to lure fans back. I understand there's a Hello Kitty bobblehead night coming up. Will this sort of thing continue, or has the sale made it unnecessary?
Well, we'll have to wait and DC on that. I know you'll be calling me after the show so you can get your own little Hello Kitty bobblehead. They've done some crazy things, but people weren't coming. And if you looked in the stands last year and you saw, like, every fifth seat had somebody in it, it was just so depressing. So there'll be a new energy with the team for sure.
Steve Dilbeck writes and blogs about the Dodgers for the L.A. Times. Steve, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Hey, it's been great.
Practically from the inception of the game, baseball and America have been, in a symbolic sense, virtually synonymous. Thus begins Mitchell Nathanson's new book, A People's History of Baseball. Mr. Nathanson, a professor of legal writing at Villanova University School of Law, joins me from Philadelphia. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hi.
You explain how the meanings and even the definitions of both baseball and America have been manipulated to serve such constituencies as the wealthy men who have owned Major League Baseball teams. Can you give me some examples?
Well, initially, baseball was considered America's game before it was America's game. And that was propagated by people who wanted to be seen as the elites. They weren't the elites. These were people who had some money but were generally left out of the upper-class clubs. We're talking in the mid to late 19th century at this point. Mm-hmm. And in the upper-crust world, participation in cricket clubs was the place where you would normally go. They were kept out of those, so they started baseball clubs and presented that to the public as America's game.
You say that the allegedly American tendency to root for an underdog, the Cubs, for example, tends to free fans up to ignore society's genuine underdogs. Explain how that works.
Well, we look at ourselves as Americans as being unique in that we root for the underdogs. And in fact, it's more a propensity of human nature than it is of being an American. The thing that makes Americans different is not that we root for the underdog. It's that when we see an underdog, we see someone who may be not the favorite, but who in our mind's eye will eventually win anyway. And what that does is it kind of blinds us to the reality of the fact that there are certain individuals and certain teams and certain groups that seem to always win.
And this makes it less likely that we'll root for any kind of real change that would help genuine underdogs outside the world of baseball, I gather.
Right. Well, we do have in this country a history of placing our faith in sort of these Horatio Alger tales, the lovable Rube who overcomes great adversity and wins ultimately. So we tend to put our faith in that, and we tend to look at that one example out of 100 where somebody did overcome, rather than looking at the 99 times out of 100 when that person didn't overcome. If you looked at the 99, you'd say to yourself, well, there seems to be something wrong here. Why don't we try to fix it?
You mentioned that in 1994, Newt Gingrich, then the driving force behind the Republican Party's contract with America, said the dispute between Major League Baseball's owners and the players would vanish in an instant if both sides sat down together and watched Field of Dreams. And you maintain that this statement was, I'm quoting now, consistent with Gingrich's prescriptions for many of society's ills. Was Mr. Gingrich alone in that point of view, or was it representative?
It was representative of a lot of people and a lot of thinking at the time. Field of Dreams is a great movie, but it has no basis in reality, and it has certainly no connection to the reality of the labor dispute that was taking place at the time. What I was talking about in terms of Newt Gingrich was he is very much a modern incarnation of this positive thinking ethos, which has been with us in American culture since the mid to late 19th century, where we tend to look at the positive, we ignore any inconvenient facts, any inconvenient realities that seem to contradict those. That's what he was talking about. He was saying, well, let's forget the labor issues. Let's all sit down. We'll watch the movie. We're going to see how wonderful baseball is, how transformative baseball is, and everyone will get together and be fine. Well, that doesn't resolve the labor issues. It doesn't resolve the problems that caused the strike in the first place.
You suggest that those who've challenged the myths and the assumptions of the baseball establishment suffer abuse for a while, and then they get assumed into the very establishment they've criticized, or at least that seems to me to be what you've said about Bill James.
Yeah, Bill James is interesting in that he, nowadays, everybody looks at Bill James as really spouting the gospel. But for many years, he was an outsider. he wasn't really tied to a particular team. His team, the Kansas City Athletics, had moved when he was a kid. So there were no teams for him to root for when he was a kid. He just chose the game itself. He started looking at baseball differently. And what happened was he started publishing his baseball abstracts in the mid-1970s. And he presented a lot of different ways of looking at the game, and he was ridiculed by those within baseball. He was seen as a guy with a slide rule and no real athletic ability, and therefore he wasn't qualified to comment on the game. But what he was doing was showing people a different way of looking at it, and in many ways a more accurate way of looking at it. Eventually, he was proven right over and over again, and the Boston Red Sox eventually hired him, and they've won two World Series ever since.
As you acknowledge in A People's History of Baseball, the National Football League has become much more popular than MLB, no matter how one measures that popularity. What, if anything, does that say about the contemporary U.S. audience?
Well, it's different, and it's different in how we watch the game. I think that what the NFL has shown is that it's more important to be good on television than it is to be good in person. And I think the thing that baseball had going for it for many years was that it was good when you were there. It was a terrible product on television. Just because of the way the game is laid out, the NFL is just much more naturally attuned to that sort of an audience. And I think that's where baseball suffered. You know, the football field looks like a television screen. I mean, it's laid out that way. And all of the action takes place usually within a five-yard burst, whereas baseball, the action doesn't take place just solely between the pitcher and the catcher and the batter. There's the things going on in the outfield. There's the moving of the runners around and things like that. You don't catch that, or you historically did not catch that on television. Although if you look at television, baseball on television now, particularly in the postseason, you do see those things. And that's why I think baseball's caught up to football.
Mitchell Nathanson, who teaches legal writing at Villanova University School of Law, is the author of A People's History of Baseball, published by the University of Illinois Press, and the author joined me from Philadelphia. Mitchell, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at TraderJoe's.com. This is NPR.
People who say they dislike soccer because there's not enough scoring should have been at the match between Wheel Power FC and Nova 2010 FC on Sunday. Nova arrived at the pitch with too few players to make up a team and had to recruit a few lads so the game could go on. And those lads must have been terrific. Nova gave up 20 goals in the first half. The final score was Wheel Power 58, Nova nada, as in nothing. Andy Woodward, who manages Wheel Power, acknowledged that the result was a bit embarrassing, but he said fair play to the other team for carrying on. They were really sporting. And the result will certainly help at the end of the season if it goes down to goal difference. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, drag racing gets carted off to the desert, to mix a metaphor. But first, for a look at the week's news, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce. He's in New Orleans this week. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. There's music outside my window.
I assume so, and I assume the Final Four party has begun.
It has. There's lots of people in red and lots of people in blue, because that's the two colors. You got Ohio State and Kansas, and of course Louisville and Kentucky. So it is the popular opinion on Bourbon Street, as I did very careful research last night, that it doesn't matter who wins or loses the Louisville-Kentucky game, there will be fistfights.
You've watched this tournament closely. Has one of the teams arrived in the Big Easy more thoroughly prepared and perhaps less banged up than the others?
Well, I think that Kentucky's arrived here with more as a more talented team than the other three. I think that, you know, I find it hard to believe that any of the three teams, the other three teams down here, can beat them. They would have to play awfully badly, and I don't think they're going to.
Former Maryland coach Gary Williams told a Washington radio station that he believes Kentucky could beat the NBA's Wizards in one game at Rupp Arena. Do you think Mr. Williams is trying to make a point that the Wildcats are really good or that the Wizards are really, really bad?
Well, knowing Gary as I do, I think he's just being a wise guy and is insinuating that the Wizards are really bad. I think they should pick another team, though. The Wizards are getting picked on by everybody in this one. Go play Kentucky. Go play Kentucky. I think Kentucky could beat him in one game, but I think it would take him 3 or 4 games to do it.
Meanwhile, despite his taking a team to the Final Four, Louisville coach Rick Pitino has reportedly been told that he will not be named as a Basketball Hall of Fame inductee on Monday. I know your general opinion on Halls of Fame is let everybody in, they're all famous, but does that apply to Rick Pitino as well?
Yeah, I think it's one of these things where he's going to have to wait his turn because he's made some enemies around the country over his career, but he'll get there sooner or later.
The Final Four women's teams have gathered in Denver, and each surviving team is a number one seed. Does this mean the people who built the brackets are really smart?
Yeah, I think what it does mean is that they're really, even more so in the men's game, there's a top level of women's college teams that's very hard to crash, and these are four really, really good teams this year.
Well, all of the teams in the women's Final Four are former NCAA champs. The previous successes of UConn, Stanford, and Notre Dame notwithstanding, I assume that you and almost everybody else is sticking with Baylor and Brittany Griner.
As long as Brittany Griner suits up, Baylor's going to beat everybody.
Major League Baseball season began with the Seattle Mariners and Oakland A's splitting 2 games in the Tokyo Dome this week. I don't know how happy the players were to start the season in Japan, but I bet Japanese fans got a kick out of seeing Ichiro Suzuki in action at home.
Well, he certainly responded to it. He had a great series over there. I'm sure there'll be some, weeping and moaning in June and July that they all got worn out from having to fly over there. Japan is baseball nutty, as we all know. This is a good idea.
I assume that lots of teams will begin the season, the baseball season, with players who are 22 or thereabouts. Only one dugout will feature an infielder who's 44. Are you surprised that Omar Vizquel earned himself a job with the Blue Jays?
Oh, the Blue Jays. I mean, the Blue Jays, first of all, the Blue Jays have a very good team and are going to be very interesting to watch this year. And they can carry a 44-year-old shortstop who can still pick it, and Omar Vizquel apparently can.
On Thursday, the Montreal Canadiens owner Jeff Molson announced that the team had fired general manager Pierre Gauthier, saying, quote, "We need to remember that our fans want us to win, period." Do you suppose the general manager had forgotten that?
I don't know, but the Canadiens, when you talk about proud franchises that are a complete mess at this point, between the Dodgers and the Canadiens, it's hard to know which one to pick.
The new CEO of IBM is a woman. Her name is Virginia Romity. And how exactly is this a sports story?
Because the CEO of IBM, and I did not know this until this week, traditionally gets themselves a membership to Augusta National, which, as we know, does not allow women to become members, which puts both IBM and Augusta National between a rock and a hard place on this one.
Wouldn't it be a great thing if the club were to invite, 400 consecutive women to join just to get this issue behind them, and all 400 women said, no, thanks very much, I don't want to?
Yeah, I think that would be a tremendous way to resolve this whole thing, but I do think they're stuck on this one because I don't think even Augusta National doesn't want to mess with IBM.
Okay, Charlie, quiz time. What do the following nations have in common vis-a-vis the 2012 Olympic soccer competition? Germany? Italy, the Netherlands, Argentina, and the United States.
Boy, that would be a group of death, wouldn't it? But actually, what they have in common is they're not playing.
It's a group of death before they even get to live in this case. No, none of those nations sending a team to the Olympics. Exactly right.
Yeah, because they have apparently the European Championships are the same year, and it doesn't apply to the United States, obviously, but all the others, or Argentina, but Germany, Italy, all those other folks find that more important. It's kind of like the X Games that way. Remember when they first put all the X Game events in the Olympics, and the traditional X Games athletes said, we don't want to go to the Olympics, we want to go to the X Games.
That's right. In honor of the Olympics, it was announced this week that the tube stations in London are all going to be renamed for accomplished Olympic athletes. So there'll be a Michael Phelps stop and an Edwin Moses stop and a Nadia Comaneci station and so on. You have dealt in person with the confusion that often attends Olympic Games. Does this seem like a good idea?
I don't think it'll be any more or less confusing. I mean, if you're from South Korea, are you going to be more confused because you have to get off at the Sebastian Coe stop instead of Waterloo or something? I mean, they're just going to think all people who speak English are nuts anyway.
In another Olympics-related development, the female beach volleyball players have been given the option of wearing shorts and sleeved shirts rather than two-piece bathing suits in order to, quote, accommodate the religious and cultural requirements of some of the competitors. This rule means less room for tattoos advertising corporate sponsors, so I would assume it would be overturned well before the games begin, right?
And 8 million TV executives are now weeping and don't know why.
And finally, Charlie, someone has allowed Jose Canseco access to a Twitter machine again. And this week, in a message to Magic Johnson, he offered to play for the Dodgers for free. And then he sent out this tweet. Al Gore was ahead of his time. I miss him. Rest in peace, buddy. Hug for you. This must have come as a terrible shock to the Gore family.
Did he just confuse him with Earl Scruggs or what?
I mean, I do not know. I mean, far be it from me to speculate what's going on in Jose Canseco's head.
Well, one thing that's going on is Al Gore is dead.
You can find Charlie Pierce's sports writing at Grantland, among other places. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie, and I hope you see some good ones down there.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it.
In my conversation earlier in the program with author Mitchell Nathanson, we discussed the appeal of underdogs. The Pittsburgh Pirates certainly qualify for that distinction, and Tim McKay, who hears Only a Game on WYPR in Baltimore, is one of their fans. Our recent story on his team in spring training provoked Mr. McKay to email as follows. Thank you for your spotlight on the Pittsburgh Pirates. Though I grew up in Maryland, I spent each summer night of my youth tucked under my bedsheets, listening to a strong signal from KDKA in Pittsburgh and the distinctive voice of Bob Prince. With our transistor radios set low so our parents couldn't hear us, my brother Denny and I would jump up in unison as Roberto Clemente peppered the field with hits or threw out some unfortunate soul who dared to round first after grounding to Roberto. Pittsburgh ownership has never subscribed to the Finley-Steinbrenner theory that a checkbook is the only way to win a World Series. As I have recently passed my 60th birthday, I rest assured that the good Lord will not call me until I see one more World Series winner in Pittsburgh. In an email headed Bugging Me, Dr. Teresa Borsig wrote, I enjoy Only a Game and I await the comments of Charlie Pierce, but I really felt sad and disappointed when he denigrated Indianapolis when the city hosted the Super Bowl. The city went all out to put on a good show, so it was disheartening to hear Charlie, whose input I generally like, dismiss it so cavalierly. Regarding another football-related matter, Ralph Kenneking wrote, Where are the owners? He was referring to the penalties assessed the general manager and two coaches associated or previously associated with the so-called bounty-hunting program of the New Orleans Saints. Why should the owner skate free? Mr. Kenneking asked. He blames Commissioner Roger Goodell for that circumstance, though he blames the owners themselves for letting, quote, a dominating, idiotic king wannabe run their league. We also heard from Don Downey in Thetford, Vermont this week. In the interest of offering suggestions and not just criticism, he wrote, Why can't you engage in conversation with your guests and not just lob them scripted softball non sequiturs? When a few interns hand you 6 or 7 questions and you read them, I start to think anyone could be sitting in your chair. You obviously haven't been listening, Mr. Downey. We only have one intern, and he doesn't write the questions, so you can't blame him. But he and I and everybody else will read whatever you send us through onlyagame.org. You can also leave a comment on the listener line, 617-353-1860. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Drag racers were double whammied last month when the last two Los Angeles area tracks, Irwindale Drag Strip and Fontana's Auto Club Dragway, shut down within a week and a half of each other. Drag racing was born in Southern California, and now there's no place close by where racers can run their hot rods. Reporter Susan Vallett recently visited the Barona Drag Strip in San Diego County, more than 100 miles away, to see how racers are coping.
Cars painted colors right out of a gumball machine line up in lanes, revving to go. Two at a time, they nudge up to the starting line at the 8th-mile track, spinning their tires to get warmed up. The Christmas tree, the bank of traffic lights between the cars, flashes yellow, then green. A lot of the drivers at the Barona drag strip raced at Fontana or Irwindale, both east of Los Angeles. A judge killed the engines at the Fontana drag strip because neighbors complained about noise. Irwindale closed because the operators went bankrupt. That was racer Jay Huck's home track, just a short drive from his home.
Sucks. It's like this car I built that I can't really drive too much on the street. It's worthless unless I trailer it out here. It took me over a year to build that motor from tax return to tax return. I got it dialed in now, and what am I going to do with it? Just leave it sit there and look at it?
So Huck trailered his hot rod and made the three-hour trek down to Barona, the next closest drag strip. The strip is on the Barona Indian Reservation, far away from any houses.
0.03 reaction time. Going to hit about 126 miles per hour. It's a 550. For Keith.
Ryan Rabe hangs out with his racing buddies at his white 57 Chevy in the Barona pits.
We're used to traveling just to Fontana. It's in our backyard. Thursday nights, if we need to shake down the cars before we do a big race, it gives us a place to go. Now to travel 240 miles all the way to Vegas or another 200 miles to Bakersfield, it makes it a little hard.
Barona track chaplain Joe Trickley knows those tracks. He's been around racing all his life. He says it can cost hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars to buy the gas to haul a trailer with a hot rod out to a drag strip. And then you have to buy racing fuel, too.
It's not cheap. So when you put those two together, it's one of the things that kind of you have to look at. All right, what are we really going to do this weekend? You know, are we really going to go? If we're involved in a series, we need to participate. Are we going to put this on the credit card? You know, how much more are we going to put on the credit card?
Professional drag racing began in 1950 on an airstrip in Orange County, California. A year later, the late Wally Parks founded the National Hot Rod Association, which held its first race in Pomona, east of Los Angeles. That's where NHRA's biggest event is, the Winter Nationals. That's also the home of the Wally Parks NHRA Motorsports Museum. Museum curator Greg Sharp says with Irwindale and Fontana closed, amateur hot rodders can't drag race anywhere near where the first legal drag strip was born.
The irony is amazing. You know, it all began here. Much of the industry began here, the speed equipment industry and aftermarket. That all began here for a lot of reasons, the weather, and during the war there were aircraft plants and shipyards where guys learned technology. So it is ironic that where it all began is the hardest place it is to find a race.
Sharp says drag strip closures have been happening for the past couple of decades all over the U.S. Late last year, Kansas City International Raceway closed to be turned into a park. Other areas have lost drag strips too, including the Emerald Coast Dragway out of Pensacola, Florida, and the Abilene Drag Strip in Texas. But Sharp says the number of closures is most prevalent in Southern California, where informal drag racing initially started on dry lake beds in the desert.
When hot rodding was developing, every place in the country didn't have a dry lake, obviously, because of the geography. But they did have surplus World War II landing strips. A lot of those became drag strips. And they were, by nature, they were in a remote location and there wasn't a lot of noise complaints. But what typically happens is the population encroaches.
And when that happens, the neighbors want quiet. The growth drives up land values, which drives out drag strips. Drag racer Kevin Watson came to check out the Barona track after Irwindale, the drag strip closest to his house, closed.
I probably won't race as much, to tell you the truth, and this is what I really enjoy. This makes me happy. This is why I get up and go to work every day. I mean, to do this on the weekends. I don't street race. I don't do any of that crap. I used to street race. I don't do it anymore. It's not worth it. They crack down on that. But if they keep taking away the tracks, you know what? All of us are probably going to go back to street racing.
Since Irwindale and Fontana closed, there have been at least two deadly street racing crashes in the area. But since drag racing hit its peak in the early 1960s, lots of Southern California drag strips have closed. Jim Wood raced on some of those old tracks.
Before, when they closed, you know, we had 12 or 14 tracks. So you lose one, you still had 12. But when you only have 5 or 6, 7, I think in Division 7 might have 9 tracks. In California, Arizona, and Nevada. So when you lose one, that's a big deal. I mean, that's a really big deal.
Motorcycle racer Bob Chagnon sits by his souped-up orange Harley, ready to go. He says it's frustrating to see drag strips close when people still want to race in Southern California.
The most cars are here, the most people to back it are here, but in the same sense of that, there are the most people to push against it. There are more people here to say no than there are people to say yes for this sport, and that's what's going on.
The racers hope that some of those tracks might someday reopen, but it may be that the sport of drag racing is driving away from Southern California. For Only a Game, I'm Susan Vallant.
I begged him not to drag anymore, but he sped off in a roar. I knew he'd head for Dead Man's Curve, just to prove he had the nerve.
Don't drag no more.
Baby, please.
Don't drag no more. Whoa. Don't drag no more. Whoa. Don't drag no more.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Jeremy Conlon. Special thanks this week to old friend Jeremy Jayhawk Bernfeld. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Susan Vallant's drag racing photo gallery, please visit onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only A Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from drag racer Jim Wood. That man's obviously in a hurry to find a strip that's still open. Littlefield, thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.